Hey, daters. Are you sick of small talk and no date being planned? Well, I'm excited to introduce you to First Rounds on Me, a revolutionary dating app designed for modern singles who are fed up with the frustrations of today's dating scene. The app is all about actually helping you plan dates and build genuine connections. How so? Well, the only way you match with someone is by planning a date. Send a date, a time, and a location, and then the rest is up to you. Ready to go on real dates? You can get one free month of their premium subscription with code DOCTOR, D-O-C-T-O-R. Download First Rounds on Me using the link in the show notes and start building meaningful connections offline. Hello and welcome to Reimagining Love. I'm Dr. Alexandra Solomon. Relationships have the power to wound us and the power to heal us. As a clinical psychologist, author, and professor at Northwestern University, I've devoted my life to studying intimate partnerships and family dynamics. On Reimagining Love, I'm here to translate complex clinical topics into tools and takeaways that you can use in your relationships today. If you're ready to develop relational self-awareness and create vibrant and loving relationships with the people who matter most to you, you've come to the right place. I'm so glad that you're here. Hi there. Welcome to another solo deep dive episode. Today, I am putting you and me directly into one of my favorite realms, which is the realm of apology and forgiveness. I'm really passionate about talking about rupture and repair for a few different reasons. Reason number one, because humans are gonna human. It is just essential. If we're gonna be in a relationship, we've gotta know how to repair. Otherwise, no relationship can get past the first disappointment. Number two, I'm also really passionate about talking about apology and forgiveness because there's a lot that we tend to get wrong about apology and forgiveness. And number three, even though apology and forgiveness take place in the space between ourselves and another person, these topics have a ton to teach us about ourselves. And that is where we're going to point our lens today. We're going to be really, really interior in this episode today. And the question we're going to unpack together is this one. Why can't I get over it? This episode is inspired in part by a DM that I got on Instagram from a woman who's been following my work for a while, and she talked about her husband's infidelity and how they've been engaging in a really diligent process of repair. And despite his efforts to tend to her pain, to hold himself accountable, she found herself asking the question, why can't I get over it? So that's kind of the impetus for this episode, is to really talk about some of the blocks that can come up inside of us when we've been hurt. These like very internal blocks that can keep us from being able to move on after a breach. Over the next two solo episodes, I'm going to be speaking to both the partner who has been hurt and to the partner who caused the harm. To help you both in this process, I created a companion worksheet to this series on repair. To access that worksheet, go to dralexandrasolomon.com/repair. Before we dive in, there are three big notes that I want to put forward right away. Number one, when I prep for today's episode, the it in the why can't I get over it that I was thinking about is relational harm. Kind of the big umbrella of relational harm, deceit, infidelity, betrayal, and boundary violations of all kind. I'm not thinking, for the purposes of this episode, about the kinds of violations or abuses that you may have suffered as a child at the hands of an adult who should have been trustworthy. I'm also not thinking of situations where the boundary violation is a sexual boundary violation or a situation of physical abuse, because situations like that, childhood abuse, or sexual assault. Situations like these involve power imbalances. They involve added layers of risk, added layers of complexity that are beyond the scope of today's conversation. For today, we're talking about relational harm, lies, betrayals, things like that. Okay, note number two. When I prepped for today's episode, I was primarily thinking about relationships where you want to rebuild trust with the person who hurt you, like that woman I mentioned in my DMs. Sometimes your best course of action is just to end the relationship with the person who hurt you and step away. And in those situations, I would, by the way, argue that you do still need to do your own interior healing work in order to make sense of what you went through, because otherwise, you risk holding other people accountable for crimes that they did not commit, so to speak. For example, if your partner cheats on you, you may very well decide to break up with them to end the relationship. And that action of breaking up may be part of how you quote unquote get over it, but you will also need a process of healing even though your former partner is no longer in your world, because the experience is still part of your world. It's part of your inner world. And that tender spot is going to be activated when you begin to build a new relationship, even if your new partner is nothing like your last partner. Why? Because building a relationship requires trust, and you went through a breach of trust. So you will still need to tend to the impact of that experience. And actually, a lot of what we're going to cover today will still be helpful to you, even though I'm going to be largely making the assumption that we're talking about a process of moving through relational harm in a situation where you want to, or at least want to try to, continue the relationship. Okay, and then note number three, while many of the scenarios I'm going to discuss today are going to be framed around a romantic relationship, a breach of trust can occur, of course, in a wide variety of relationships and situations, and the principles I'm going to talk you through today can absolutely be applied to repairing a friendship or a relationship with a relative, for example. Okay, so how do we define quote unquote getting over it, right? That's the title of this episode. Why can't I get over it? I have a hunch that part of the answer to this question, why can't I get over it, is hiding out inside of the framing of the question. So let's just take a moment and look at this phrase, getting over it. I think this phrase is problematic. And the phrase itself, the language itself, may be a part of what blocks healing. This phrase, getting over it, is reminiscent of a kind of either or language that I hear a lot in my therapy work. I want to stop feeling this way. I want to stop thinking like this. I want to break this pattern. I don't want to act like this anymore. I want to get over this. Do you hear it? It's kind of a binary either or framing. I was A and now I'm B. I was like this and now I stop being like this. And I think we do this around mental health or relational health matters because we do it in the medical world. I was diabetic. I'm now not diabetic. I did test positive for this virus. I now do not test positive for this virus. And probably medical or physical stuff works like this. I was, and now I'm not. Kind of more like an on-off switch. But I would posit to you, when it comes to our emotional and our relational worlds, that either or is wishful thinking. There really is no such thing as forgive and forget, because memories linger and experiences change us. But I have a deep respect for the underlying wish. That underlying wish of wanting to get over something is a wish for the pain to stop. It's perhaps a wish for the intrusive thoughts to subside. It's perhaps a wish to be able to see the other person the way that you used to be able to see them. It's maybe a wish to feel on the inside the way that you used to feel. It's a wish perhaps to return to a simpler time, the time before all of this stuff happened. Or perhaps it's a wish for the past to just stay put in the past rather than popping up in the here and now all the time. I think that bottom line, the desire to quote, get over it is a desire to almost like undo the thing that's been done. The desire to get over it is perhaps also a desire to bypass the grief that accompanies the awareness that relational harm or betrayal is not to be gotten over. It is to be carried ever more gently, ever more gracefully. And our emotional and our relational wounds demand that kind of nuance. We cannot push a button or take a pill or wave a wand and have it be over, much as we wish it would be. Relational harm is to be worked. It is to be honored. It is to be witnessed, addressed, processed, and integrated into a larger narrative of self, of other, and of relationship. Ugh. Okay. I get it. That is hard, right? This idea of like just getting over it seems so much easier. And as you've heard me say on our show, our relationships will not get easier. And exhibit, you know, number 172 is this framing right now of the idea that getting over it is wishful thinking. But what we can do is develop more capacity to make sense of really hard, messy stuff. And that's just it. So when someone says to me, I want to get over this, my next move is to work with them to really operationalize what this means. I want them to paint me a picture. What does getting over this look like? And so my follow-up questions might include questions like this. One, can you talk with me about what getting over it looks like for you? Two, if you were over this, what would you be doing and saying differently? Three, if you were over it, what would you no longer be doing? Four, if you were over it, how would you feel on the inside? Five, if you were over it, what would you believe to be true about yourself? Six, if you were over it, what would you believe to be true about the person who hurt you? Seven, if you were over it, what would time with that person look like and feel like for you? And for somebody who's trying to move through pain and rebuild trust or restore connection with somebody who hurt them, their answers to those questions tend to sound like this. I'd be thinking about the harmful experience less frequently. When memories of the harmful experience came up, I would find those memories to be less distressing. So they'd hold kind of less power to emotionally upset me. I would be able to remember that I am more than just this painful experience. I would begin to feel like myself again. Maybe not like my old self, but at least I would feel like a version of myself that feels recognizable. I would be able to remember that this thing happened to me, but it does not define me. I would be able to see the other person as more than their harmful behavior. I would be able to feel their commitment to living in their own integrity, and this would help me feel safer in their presence. I would be able to bring up the painful memory if and when it's troubling me, not to punish my partner, but to let them know that I'm having a hard time in that particular moment. I'd be able to have fun with this person rather than feeling flat or scared or sad or angry all the time. Getting over it then is really about a pain that begins to become a pang. It's about integrating a painful chapter into a larger story. It's about making space for more than just that painful experience. It's a reclamation of sorts. It's an expansion of possibilities. It's the restoration of trust in yourself, trust in the other person, and trust in the relationship. Okay, here's something else I want to talk with you about before we get too far in. By the way, where we're going is I'm teeing us up to talk about seven areas where you might be stuck. So that's what we're moving towards. I'm just taking us a moment to get there. As you know, I sometimes do because I want to lay some stuff out. This is a hard episode. So, you know, drink some water, take me for a walk, and I'm going to keep on rolling here because I want to really set you up to take in these seven ideas. So we're almost there. Okay, so before we go any further, though, I want to be super clear about this part. When we think about forgiveness and when we think about putting the past in the past, there are three elements. One, the part that's about the person who's been hurt. Two, the part that's about the person who did harm. And three, the part that's about the dynamic between the two people. So think my stuff plus your stuff equals our stuff. And in this episode, I'm going to get really granular and really specific with you about what might be happening inside of you that is keeping you from being able to move on from a painful experience. But I want to say loudly and clearly that if you're asking yourself, ugh, why can't I get over this? The answer may very well live somewhere else besides inside of you. Your difficulty moving on may very well be rooted in an interpersonal problem. For example, perhaps the person who has hurt you has not apologized. It is very hard to move on from a breach that has not been witnessed or validated. In that scenario, you are carrying the story of the breach all alone. So of course your pain keeps coming up again and again and again. Your pain is noisy because it has not been heard. Can you heal from a hurt in the absence of an apology? Yes. Forgiveness can be a gift that you give yourself to spare yourself the burden of carrying old pain. But it is very difficult, I would perhaps even say impossible, to feel close to someone who refuses to apologize for the pain that their behavior created inside of you. You can stay in a relationship with that person, but the relationship is then very likely founded in things like duty or obligation or history or formality, not founded in things like ease and emotional safety and vulnerability and intimacy. Here's another way that there might be an interpersonal constraint. Perhaps the person's apology was half-hearted or inadequate. Here are some examples of a lousy, inadequate, half-hearted apology. I'm sorry, but it wasn't that bad. I'm sorry, but you did something similar. I'm sorry, but I wouldn't feel hurt if you did that to me. I'm sorry, but at least I didn't do that other thing, which would have been so much worse. Or I'm sorry you feel hurt. Or I'm sorry if I hurt you. Right? It's hard to move on when the apology has been half-hearted or half-assed. Perhaps they offered an apology, but you aren't seeing behavior change. For example, they are not cheating on you any longer, but they're continuing to behave in ways that are evasive or inconsistent. So therefore, your difficulty rebuilding trust, your difficulty moving on, makes sense in that context, right? There may be very real relational reasons that you're having a hard time moving on. Okay, so having said all that, let us now focus our attention just on you. Let's see if we can surface and make some sense of the you variables that might be blocking your healing. I want to talk you through, like I said, 7 different reasons why you might be having a hard time moving on. But I want you to be clear. Looking at these variables together does not mean that your stuckness is your fault. You can't flick a switch and feel forgiveness. It's a process. And if you're beating yourself up for how long the process is taking, I hope that this episode opens up some self-compassion for you because repair takes time. And certainly, if you are listening and you are wishing that your partner would move on from harm that you caused, I'm telling you right now, you do not have my permission to place these 7 elements at your partner's feet as evidence of the fact that the relationship is struggling because your hurt partner is stuck. Do you see what I mean? If you are listening, I'm talking in this episode as if the person I'm talking to, you, is the person who's been hurt. But I know full well that the person I'm talking to might be the person who did harm. I'm going to be returning to this topic again and focusing more on the person who did harm and diving into some of those internal constraints. So you're next, my dear. You are not off the hook. I have tons of compassion, right? I have tons of compassion for, you know, the times that we are hurtful and we do hurt when we don't mean to do hurt, but we're going to come back to that element of it. Right now, we're focusing on ways in which the person who has been hurt is getting stuck. Okay, here we go. Reason number 1 that you may be having a hard time moving along. Because you've been taught that forgiveness equals weakness. In our culture, we tend to make a false equivalence between holding a grudge and having power. holding a grudge feels like a one-up position. It feels powerful. When you are holding a grudge, when you're withholding forgiveness, there's like an ability to kind of dangle something over somebody else's head. Not saying that that's the primary reason that you're doing it, but it ends up being this kind of strange side effect of not forgiving, is that there's a little bit of a power position in it. And if that's the perception that you have, it makes total sense then that forgiveness feels like weakness. It's an act then of stepping out of that powerful position, surrendering power, moving back into equal footing. This also ties to something that feels incredibly heightened here in the US these days during this time of polarization. There's this kind of like gotcha stance, you know, like having the goods on somebody is powerful. It makes you sort of invulnerable. And there are very few things in this world that make us feel as vulnerable as falling in love. So it makes sense then that we might grasp extra tightly to something that gives us an illusion of safety, especially in the wake of feeling hurt. And none of us enter a relationship expecting to be hurt. And when trust is breached, it hurts. It hurts so badly. When trust is breached, you're thrown into a destabilizing situation. One in which you feel like now you have to be looking out for yourself. You feel like you have to have your own back all of a sudden. And given that sense that you have, that you need to protect yourself, it's really understandable that you carry a fear of being weak, or being perceived as weak, or being at risk of being taken advantage of by forgiving the person who's done harm. And there may be a deeper layer here for you that fuels your fear. Maybe you've seen people in your life be repeatedly and systematically mistreated by a family member or a partner, and you do not want the same for yourself. So understandable. So you are therefore on the lookout for any evidence that you're falling into that same trap. If that part lands for you, that part of this equivalence you make between forgiveness and weakness is that you saw when you were growing up somebody kind of repeatedly excusing somebody else's bad behavior. If that part lands for you, it might be helpful for you just to challenge yourself a little bit to tease apart how your situation is different from what you witnessed and experienced growing up. What resources do you have available to you that the people in your family of origin perhaps did not have? What skills or accountability does your partner have that perhaps the person you saw doing harm when you were growing up does not have or did not have? As you tease these differences apart, it's not so that you can feel better than the people that you saw when you were growing up, but so that you can ground yourself in this context that you are in today, right here, right now, and that you have a set of choices that are based on your situation. You don't need to make your choices based on the history that you saw. You get to make your choices with your eyes wide open around your situation, not the one that you saw when you were little. And I will tell you that when I'm working with a couple that is trying to explore the possibility of recovery after infidelity, which is, by the way, the bulk of my couple's cases in any given moment, I am explicit about the courage that it takes to even consider forgiveness. This cultural message that equates forgiveness with weakness has a really horrible impact on those who are even attempting to rebuild after infidelity. And sometimes there's a gendered element. A man who's considering forgiving a woman who cheated on him can feel like less of a man or can feel emasculated. A woman who's considering forgiving a man can feel like a doormat or like a weak woman who can't stand on her own two feet. So that equating of forgiveness with weakness can have like a gendered overlay also. As if being cheated on is not hard enough already, people who are in this spot often feel an added layer of shame that comes from this idea that only a fool would consider forgiving and rebuilding. And I disagree. Anyone who's willing to engage in an emotional process with an uncertain outcome is a badass in my book. In fact, for a lot of people, this fear that forgiveness equals weakness drives them to precipitously end a relationship after a breach of trust, just purely out of fear of feeling weak or fear of being perceived as weak. It's like the breakup is the attempt to bypass the shame and the vulnerability that's evoked by even attempting to engage in a process of repair. And listen, I will never, ever tell you that staying is better than leaving or that leaving is better than staying after a breach of trust. But I will tell you that you deserve to make choices that feel like you are choosing something here, choosing to see what might be possible versus making choices that are designed to help you avoid something that you perceive as bad or shameful. Here, the idea that forgiveness is weakness. Okay. Reason number two that you might be having a hard time moving on is because perhaps you just need more time. Hurt hurts, and you may very well have a timeline in your mind about when you should be over it. Or worse, you may have people in your life who are asking you, why aren't you over it yet? Or telling you that you should be over it. And here's the problem. Repair does not fit neatly on a timeline, and hurt has zero F's to give about days on a calendar. The key ingredients are time and intention. Time alone is not enough to heal without intention, and intention alone is not enough to heal without time. You need both. Okay, indulge me in just a little bit of nerdiness for a moment. I want to talk about affective chronometry, in part because it's just so darn fun to say. Affective chronometry is the study of how people experience their emotions over a period of time. Our affective chronometry is therefore a part of our emotion regulation. It's how we experience and manage our emotions over time, how we respond to the frustrating and stressful and sad things that happen to us. And research by Dr. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Healthy Minds shows that we are genetically predisposed towards being relatively quicker to get upset or relatively slower to get upset, relatively quicker to move on or relatively slower to move on. In other words, we cannot make some abstract timeline for healing because not all wounds are the same and not all people who are experiencing those wounds are the same. They're not experiencing them in the same way. If you're feeling frustrated or confused about why you can't move on, quote unquote, can't move on, do a little bit of self-reflection here. Whose timeline are you on? What is your evidence that you, quote, should be further along in your healing than you are? Who's saying that? Whose voice is that? To what degree is your desire to rush your process a desire to be done with the pain? To what degree is your desire to rush your process a desire to get out of the spotlight? Hang here for a moment because that last one is a little funky. But here's the deal. For some of us, needing to recover from relational harm is highly uncomfortable. And I'm not talking about uncomfortable because of the pain, but uncomfortable because of the focus. When you've been hurt, there's a focus on you. The person who hurt you is hopefully catering to you, checking in on you, asking you what you need. There's a lot of focus, a lot of energy kind of coming your way. It's a lot of attention. And perhaps it's more power than you are accustomed to. It's more attention than you're accustomed to. If you are somebody who is more comfortable tending to others, you may have a really freaking hard time being tended to. And your desire to quote unquote get over it may be in part a desire to get back into your more comfy role of being the easy one or being the helper. Trauma therapists love to say that the goal of the work is to go slow to go fast. You're going to integrate trauma more effectively and more efficiently if you continue to just check in with yourself. To what degree are you feeling present and calm and open versus irritable, which is hyper arousal, or numb and flat, which is hypo arousal. So think about those two ends of the spectrum, like the hyper arousal is one end, the hypo arousal is the other end. And then in that middle ground is what we call the zone of tolerance. Be careful to not force yourself into long conversations or uncomfortable experiences in an effort to push your limits and to desensitize yourself. You're going to end up creating the exact opposite effect. instead stay in this middle space, this what Dan Siegel calls this zone of tolerance, that middle space of feeling emotionally regulated, present, engaged, like only go so far in conversation or in experience until you start to feel like, ugh, I'm outside of that kind of zone of tolerance. And when you do that, when your main number one goal is to kind of stay in that middle range, you're going to, your process is going to unfold with more efficiency and with more effectiveness, not on some abstract timeline, but just on your timeline. Like you're stacking the deck in your own favor when you honor your zone of tolerance, your window of tolerance. Research has found, by the way, that it is not uncommon for people who've been cheated on to meet the criteria for PTSD, for post-traumatic stress disorder. This research finding speaks to the severity of the impact of this kind of breach. It speaks to the need for therapeutic support. It speaks to the need for time to heal. And we're talking months and years, not days and weeks. And it speaks to the need for self-compassion. By the way, I created a self-guided e-course for couples who are considering rebuilding their relationship in the wake of deceit or betrayal. And you can find that course, which is called Can I Trust You Again, at courses.dralexandrasolomon.com, or you can just go to the link that's in the show notes. And in that course, I spend quite a bit of time talking about how couples can cope with the emotional dysregulation that accompanies betrayal. And there's in fact a worksheet of grounding strategies that people are finding quite helpful. So it takes time because it takes time. It takes time because hurt hurts. And the more that you pressure yourself or the more somebody else in your life pressures you about, come on, hurry it up, the more your pain's going to be like, oh, you want me to go fast? Well, then I'm just going to plant myself right here. Okay, reason number three that you may be having a hard time moving along is that you may need some more experiences of trust and safety. Relationships are built on emotional safety and trust. And once that has been broken or breached, your mind may want to forgive them, but trust and safety are felt experiences. You can't simply tell your brain to trust someone. It's something that has to be felt. It's an embodied experience. And when I think about rebuilding trust, I think about how we need top-down and bottom-up experiences. And I think it's really easy for us to underestimate the power of those bottom-up experiences. Let me explain. Top-down processing is listening to our partner's words and lining them up with their actions, with prior knowledge, etc. It's a top-down process. We're taking the data from the world around us and making sense of it. Bottom-up processing is when our bodies are taking in the stimuli. It's the felt sense. It's the way our body feels near the other person. It's our senses. It's our emotions that we're feeling in a conversation. And all of that data comes up and becomes our thoughts. And because trust and safety are embodied experiences, they really do need to be fostered in a bottom-up kind of way, like repeatedly. It's the difference between saying and doing. You and your partner can have long chats about what happened, and you can agree to move forward, and that is important. I'm here for conversation. But you also need to feel that sense of warmth and safety and trust. And that comes from experiences together. So things that, you know, letting yourself kind of stretch and risk into some shared, pleasant, pleasurable experiences together. And they will not feel the same as they did before. But those kinds of experiences of being near your partner, feeling like your guard is down, even if it's just by like one little hair of an inch, like those are the experiences that also kind of compound over time and become that felt sense of safety, that felt sense of trust. By the way, I also have found in my work that for couples who can afford to, traveling together when couples are in that process of healing from relational harm, healing from a breach of trust, traveling together can be a really important element of rebuilding trust. I think there's a few reasons for that. Number one, the couple is kind of getting themselves out of the familiar surroundings, and the familiar surroundings can often be full of triggers that can kind of bring up the breach of trust. Number two, I think because then the couple is creating the conditions to experience something new together and perhaps have to lean on each other in this new environment. And those, again, are opportunities to build that bottom-up sense of trust. And number three, I think the reason that travel is helpful is that it allows couples to create new memories. And for the one who's been hurt, these new, pleasant, pleasurable memories can sort of cushion the impact of the painful memories. It's not about swapping out or overriding or invalidating the painful memories. It's about layering in and softening with new and positive ones. Okay, reason number four that might be hard for you to move on is because this experience shattered your belief in a just world. In psychology, the just world phenomenon is our tendency to want to believe that the world is just, that the world is fair. This idea of kind of like karma, that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. People want to believe that the world is fair and that things happen for a reason because it's a way of creating sense out of our often chaotic and seemingly random world. And what research finds is that there are some pros and some cons to this mindset. We're all prone to this mindset, but some of us are more prone than others. Some of us have had our belief in a just world shattered, you know, pretty early in our lives, and others of us get to or choose to cling to it longer. In some ways, this belief in a just world protects your optimism and allows you to feel extra good about yourself for doing positive actions. But the shadow or the con of believing in a just world is that it can lead people to seek rationalizations for injustices and harmful events. It basically creates the conditions for victim blaming, right? If good things happen to good people, then bad things must happen to bad people because of something that they had done. Okay, so why do we do it? Again, because of a fear of vulnerability. We don't like thinking that we could be vulnerable and at risk of dealing with scary things in the world. And we create a sense of security for ourselves when we are believing in a just world. The idea is if you avoid behaviors that you think cause bad events to happen, then you avoid being a victim. The belief also stems from a desire to just feel less anxious, even though I think it probably in some ways has a counter effect because then you get anxious about doing the wrong thing and ending up a victim. If you're somebody who has been kind of prone to this belief, it means that you might have subconsciously judged others for the bad things that have happened to them. Right? You may have, when you heard a story about some unfortunate event, your brain might have filled in, well, that only happened to them because of this choice that they made. And in thinking that, well, that bad thing happened to that person because of a choice that they made. In thinking that, you are kind of trying to make yourself feel safe. Okay, well, so now here you are. You're in a world of hurt. A bad thing has happened to you, and you might be struggling to process this experience because this experience of being cheated on or of being lied to really confronts your belief in a just world. So that might be part of your stuckness. If you have previously operated under the idea that behaving well means that life goes your way, then what are you supposed to do with this experience? And you might have a hard time really facing it and really processing it because it puts you then at risk of blaming the experience on yourself. It must be that I wasn't fun enough. It must be that I wasn't taking care of my partner's needs. It must be that I was putting too much pressure on them. These are not valid thoughts. I am not giving these thoughts any validity. They are self-destructive thoughts. They are distorted thoughts. But they are the downstream thoughts that come from a belief in a just world. Bottom line, your work here is to grieve the loss of your belief in a just world, right? That has been shattered. This experience of relational harm has shattered your belief in a just world. That belief gave you comfort, but it was always a false comfort. It was always a simplistic comfort. And you now have the chance to move from kind of a black and white view of the world to a view of the world that holds shades of gray. Bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen. Stuff happens. Life happens. And rather than feeling helpless without a perceived safety of being good, you can now feel powerful knowing that you can be resilient and brave and kind in the face of things that are unfair or unseen or undesirable. You are letting go of a belief in a just world, and you are embracing a view of the world that accepts that bad things happen to good people and that we cannot prevent pain by living according to a set of rules and values. Here are a few relational self-awareness questions that you can use as you challenge yourself to move away from a belief in a just world. Number one, to what degree did my family of origin instill in me a belief in a just world? I.e., if a bad thing happens to somebody, they must have deserved it. Number two, what did a belief in a just world protect me from feeling? Number three, who am I without that belief in a just world? Number four, what part of me feels like I still need to believe in a just world? Number five, what part of me trusts that I can be brave and kind even in the face of unpredictability? Okay, by the way, tied in here is something that has been found a number of times in the social psychological research about forgiveness. I was reading an article, a 2018 article by Pierce and Strelin and Burns in a journal called Personality and Individual Differences. What they found is that one of the most common barriers to forgiveness is that the victim feels like the offender's behavior is morally repugnant. That feeling of moral outrage blocks forgiveness. It's a tough one, right? Therapists like to say that it's hard to forgive those who sin differently than we do. And I think that's a little bit flippant because the feelings of moral outrage are real. Like it's real that you, when somebody does something that you find morally outrageous or morally repugnant, it leads you to see that person in a different light. And then, by the way, sometimes it leads you to bend that arrow back to yourself, right? I see you in a different light because you did this thing that I find so morally reprehensible. But now I see myself in a different light because I'm partnered with somebody who is capable of doing something that I judge and deem as morally wrong. Now, listen, I would never tell you to drop your morals, but I do think, as with that just world belief that we were talking about a moment ago, an experience of relational harm can lead us to examine our morals and to ask ourselves about the risks and the benefits of being perhaps a little bit less absolute in our moral stance and a little bit more relative. Right? The risk of loosening or softening our moral vision is that we might feel less virtuous, but the benefit of loosening or softening our moral vision is that we might feel more compassionate towards all of human foibles and human frailties. Reason number five that you may be having a hard time moving on, because you have not attended to the old pain that this new pain is chained to. So you perhaps have heard me say before that grief is synergistic. Today's pain resonates with pain from years ago, and each one amplifies the other. The old pain amplifies the new pain reawakens the old pain. So it's possible that this wrongdoing feels extra tender and you're struggling to move on because this wrongdoing is connected to an old wound. Perhaps you've been betrayed or mistreated before. Perhaps it reinforces a belief that you have about yourself that emerges from your family of origin. And especially, by the way, if your partner knew about your past history, it can be that much harder to forgive them for this indiscretion. Like, how could they have done this to you when they know about your past wound? If this rings true to you, I'm going to encourage you to take some time to journal about the past pains that this current situation is awakening for you. Like, take some time to honor those old pains that are tied to this current pain. And make sure that in addition to writing about that old pain, you perhaps also write about the tools and the resources that you have right here, right now, today, that you did not have back then. Today's situation may hold echoes of that old situation, but make sure you focus on what's different. Is it possible, perhaps, that as you tend to your pain today, you are also offering some witnessing to that younger version of yourself, right? By honoring your pain and your process today, you are perhaps doing a little bit of re-grieving, or perhaps for the first time grieving that old pain that you still carry with you that's being awakened today. Think about then also visiting or revisiting the episode I did on Reimagining Love, which is called Tending to Little You. That's also a really good resource. And that link you'll find in the show notes. Okay, moving on to number six. Number six reason about why you may have a hard time moving on is because you haven't yet forgiven yourself. I think especially in our romantic relationships, we are prone to taking betrayal personally, especially the betrayal of infidelity. It is the nature of our romanticized notions of intimate partnership that the foundation of the relationship is the specialness of choosing and of being chosen of all possible partners out there. This person chose you. You chose them. There's an exclusivity to that, a feeling of irreplaceability to that. That is really central to our ability to feel safe. And infidelity shatters that for sure in a way that is confusing, in a way that is devastating. And you may be creating a story inside your head about what it is about you that led your partner to choose someone else, even if it was only for a brief moment. And yes, betrayal happens in a context. Betrayal often happens in a context of disconnection, in a context of disengagement, in a context of disrespect, whatever. But context does not equal blame. You may very well have participated in co-creating a context in which this relational harm occurred. And that does not mean it's your fault. It does not mean you deserved it. But all of that is easy to say, and it can be hard to believe. So part of what might be keeping you stuck in your pain is the way in which you are blaming yourself for what happened. You may be stuck in part because you have yet to forgive yourself. And this self-blame might be fueled by a cultural narrative about how a good boyfriend or a good girlfriend or a good husband or a good wife makes their partner feel. And this self-blame may, frankly, be coming from your self-awareness. You may be able to look clearly at the history and see, yeah, there are some ways where I let my partner down. Yeah, there are some things I said to my partner that were hurtful. Yeah, I was distracted or shut down for whatever reasons. Okay, fine. That does not mean you deserved to be betrayed. That does not mean it's your fault that you were betrayed. And self-compassion is the order of the day here. If self-flagellation was the gateway to liberation, you would be free of your pain by now. Beating yourself up is a dead-end road. It, in fact, creates more stuckness because beating yourself up becomes its own kind of hall of mirrors. When you're in that hall of mirrors, beating yourself up, blaming yourself, not forgiving yourself, you can't be on the lookout for new experiences. You're not available for new experiences. You're not taking in new stories about yourself, about your partner, about the relationship. So the questions are, can you let yourself off the hook? What might it be like to let yourself off the hook? Can you acknowledge that you didn't know then what you know now? Can you consider living by Dr. Maya Angelou's words? Do the best you can until you know better. Then, when you know better, do better. What might it look like to do better now? What is the risk of forgiving yourself? What is the benefit of forgiving yourself? Okay, final reason, reason number seven, that you may be having a hard time moving on. This is a tough one. Because there may be for you some secondary gains of withholding forgiveness. Secondary gains, meaning like hidden benefits, hidden goodies of withholding forgiveness. There's a lot of research that shows that there are very clear benefits to forgiving. It tends to relieve us of the negative physical toll, the negative emotional toll that holding a grudge or withholding forgiveness takes on us. And forgiveness holds the power to restore an important relationship. That 2018 article I was telling you about before, these researchers talked also about the reactive reasons that people withhold forgiveness. That was that moral repugnance I was telling you about before. Well, they also talked about the active reasons. So reactive reasons and active reasons. There are active reasons that people withhold forgiveness. And the active reason that people withhold forgiveness is that when you refuse to forgive, you protect yourself from power and identity threats. This is called grudge theory by a guy named Baumeister, a psychologist named Baumeister. Okay, so what does that mean? Protecting yourself from power and identity threats. The idea here is that when you withhold forgiveness, you maintain a perceived right to compensation, like the other person owes you. You assert a kind of moral superiority. You have influence over the person who hurt you. So there's some secondary gains of not getting over something, of not putting the past in the past. There's a kind of emotional safety in holding a grudge. If you forgive this person, or when you forgive this person, you are once again making yourself vulnerable to them. You might be understandably afraid that if you go back to normal, this person may take advantage of you and repeat the same harmful actions. So this is a good time to check in with yourself. Are there some ways, perhaps, that you are gleaning a sense of power from the grudge? Right? What are the ways in which this grudge or withholding forgiveness or keeping this relational harm kind of front and center, what are the ways that that might be protecting you? What is it protecting you from? And can you get in touch with this fear of feeling powerless or of feeling less than? And can you kind of get in touch with the idea that withholding forgiveness is perhaps helping you feel powerful? By what other means could you feel powerful in the relationship? In my second book, which is called Taking Sexy Back, I shared what I call the trust, risk, self-compassion triangle. So imagine a triangle with those on the corners of the triangle. Trust in one corner, risk in one corner, self-compassion in one corner. I wrote about this trust, risk, self-compassion triangle in a section of the book that was about sexual fantasies and what you need to have in place if you're interested in bringing a fantasy from your mind into reality. So I talked about needing to have trust in your partner, needing to have a willingness to take a risk, which by definition, a risk means that the outcome is uncertain. And third, needing to have self-compassion, which is a promise that you won't turn against yourself if the whole thing crashes and burns. So that was talking about trust and risk and self-compassion in terms of like kind of sexual experimentation and trying something new that you're not really sure how it's going to work out when you try it in real life. And I think for as different as the scenarios are, this trust, risk, self-compassion triangle is helpful in this conversation about moving on from harm because you need to have at least a modicum of trust in the other person because they've offered a heartfelt apology, because they're working on changing their behavior. You need to have at least a modicum of willingness to take risks because healing requires the creation of new experiences. And new experiences can only happen if you take a little bit of risk, risking a new conversation, risking physical touch, risking going on an adventure, risking not checking their phone a bunch of times when you're together, et cetera, et cetera. And third, you need to have self-compassion. Moving through relational harm means engaging in a process with an uncertain outcome. You don't know how it's going to turn out. You're engaging in a process with an uncertain outcome. So that self-compassion piece is that promise you make that you will not turn against yourself and say that you were a fool for having tried. It's a cheap shot. You're a badass for having tried. Okay. We covered a lot of ground talking about seven potential internal psychological you reasons why you may be having a difficult time moving through relational harm and moving into forgiveness. So, remembering, of course, that you may be having a difficult time healing from relational harm because of stuff inside the person who did harm, inside the relationship dynamic or inside of you. And so today we just focused on the inside of you part. just by way of review, reason number one that you may be stuck is you've been taught that forgiveness equals weakness. Reason number two, you may need more time. Reason number three, you may need to kind of keep building up that bank of experiences of safety and trust. Number four, because this experience shattered your belief in a just world. Number five, because you have not yet attended to the old pain that the new pain is chained to. Number six, because you've not yet forgiven yourself. And number seven, because there are some sneaky secondary gains of withholding forgiveness. Thank you so much for joining me for another solo episode here on Reimagining Love. If you want access to this episode's companion worksheet, go to dralexandrasolomon.com/repair. By way of preview, next month, I'm going to be coming back to this topic, talking a bit more about repair from the perspective of the person who did harm. As always, feedback is my love language. So if this episode brought up questions for you, please reach out. You can email me at info@dralexandrasolomon.com. You can submit a listener question using the link in the show notes. Okay, I'll see you back here next week on Reimagining Love. Until next time, be well. Do you have a relationship question that you want answered on the show? Visit reimagininglove.com to send in a written or audio question. Questions can be about intimate partnerships, family relationships, friendships, you name it. If you're looking for more love and relationship content, you can find me on Instagram at dr.alexandra.solomon or visit my website, dralexandrasolomon.com, where you'll find my blog as well as the Intimate Relationships 101 e-course based off of the popular class I teach at Northwestern University. Thank you for listening and see you next week here on Reimagining Love.